This recording is from FinTech Nexus USA, formerly known as London FinTech USA, held at the Javits Center in New York City on May 25th to 26th, 2022. It's from our keynote stage and is titled, Why Every Bank Needs a Crypto Strategy. Speaking on the session are Terry Angelos from Drive Wealth with Alan Lane from Silvergate Bank.
So hi, my name is Terry Angelos. I'm the CEO of a company called Drive Wealth, which is a global fintech infrastructure company, provides API access to equities and crypto. But I'm doing a bit of double duty. Up until last week, I was the head of fintech and crypto at Visa. And it's in that context that I got to know Alan. So Alan Lane, the CEO of Silvergate Bank, which is a Fed member bank focused on crypto. So welcome.
Thanks, Terry. It's good to be here. Good morning, everybody.
So I'll kick it off. Sometime last year at Visa, we interviewed about 6,000 consumers around the world. They were, the head of household, and asked them a whole bunch of questions around how they view crypto and, you know, digital assets. And one of the questions we asked them was, how likely would you be to switch your bank to one that offered crypto services? And over a third of respondents said that they would. So my first question is, if you're running a traditional bank, how do you think crypto will impact you?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm not sure that we know the answer to that yet. So one of the things that a lot of community banks are doing right now is they're partnering with a firm called NYDIG to provide access for their customers to be able to buy Bitcoin. And so that's an interesting experiment. But for anybody in the audience who's been in banking for a while, I've been in banking for 40 years. And I remember back in the 90s, community banks started offering investment products. You know, it was already being done at the big banks, but there was this concept of, okay, well, we're going to start licensing sales reps inside the bank branch in the lobby to sell investment products to community bank customers. And everybody rushed to do that. And then along came the fintechs a few years later and started offering stuff, you know, and then the iPhone came out and the Android. And so, excuse me, it's not clear to me that a lot of retail community bank branch customers will actually want to buy Bitcoin from their local branch. But as you just said, Visa, that survey indicated that that might be an opportunity. So at Silvergate, we're really institutionally focused. We don't have branches. We don't have consumer clients directly. So we enable digital currency platforms to offer cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and other digital assets to their customers.
All right. Well, let's come back to that consumer point. I think I have a different view. But your journey is interesting. When we talk to banks in the Visa context, and we sort of sit between the banks and kind of, you know, the crypto exchanges. And one of the questions we asked many of our crypto clients is, what do you want from banks? And their first, I was expecting they would say, oh, it'd be great if banks built their own stable coins. And the answer was, could you just bank us? Could you just take the money in fiat that we have quite a lot of it, and safely store it? That's kind of how a small bank in La Jolla, which is where you guys are located, started. So tell me about your journey from banking crypto customers to where you are today, which is a lot more kind of crypto native solutions like the SEN network.
Yeah, so it's interesting to me that that's still, that's still kind of the number one request, which indicates that we're still really early. And that's a common theme. I think we're real early. I had a chance to listen to some of the previous panel. What we saw back in 2013 was that there were these new companies being formed to provide services to this new digital asset called Bitcoin. And I was reading about Bitcoin in 2013, and what I was reading was that with Bitcoin, you could be your own bank. And I thought, well, gosh, that's interesting. I wonder how that's going to work. And as we went down and started exploring what were these companies trying to do, they were essentially kind of new fintechs, a lot of them, just providing a new service. But because they were deemed to be money service businesses, there was this whole banking regulatory overlay about how banks needed to interact with these companies. And because it was so new and it was small, most banks were just stiff-arming it and saying, you know what, we're not going to touch this. And we were small, and by big bank standards, we're still small. We're about $15 billion in assets now, but back then we were under a billion. So what we saw was a new industry potentially being formed that was raising venture capital money. So they had deposits. We were a bank. We're still a bank. We need deposits. And they were being shunned by the broader banking ecosystem. So where other folks just saw risk, we saw potential opportunity, provided we could bank these companies in a regulatory compliant, safe and sound manner. And so that's what we set out to do, was build a regulatory compliance program to be able to bank this ecosystem. It started small, started as a deposit initiative to fund our lending activities. And as we fast forward here now, 8 years later, we've steered the entire bank into this strategy. And we no longer look at it as a source of deposits. Deposits are a byproduct of what we do at this point.
But I mean, just to be clear, the banking activity with crypto is a traditional banking one. You're taking fiat deposits. It sounds like the secret innovation was a compliance department.
It certainly was in the early days. And so our competitive advantage, which we knew was not sustainable, which takes us to where we are today, but we had two advantages up front in 2014. So we opened our first account for a Bitcoin-related company in January of 2014. And our competitive advantage was we were willing to talk to them. And we were building a regulatory compliant platform. But our view was that was not sustainable, right? Eventually, if this took off, every bank in the country was going to have to figure out how they were going to bank this new asset class. And there were a lot of banks across the country, much bigger than we were, that could throw money at building a regulatory compliant program. And so that's really where we transitioned in 2016 to creating what has become really critical infrastructure for the ecosystem. And it's a product that we call the Silvergate Exchange Network, or the SEN. And what it does is it allows our customers to transfer U.S. dollars between themselves 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is, coincidentally, the hours that the cryptocurrency markets trade. They never sleep. And so we were, I think, the first bank in the world to bring the legacy banking system that only operates normal business hours, Monday to Friday, into the cryptocurrency 24/7, 365 global trading market.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, I think, a fascinating use case that we've observed both at Visa and at DriveWealth, where we, power equities trading, where you have all this trading activity in the traditional world interrupted by wire cutoff times as you do settlement. So why don't we chat a little bit about stablecoins?
Yep.
I think the previous panel covered a bit of this. And maybe just how do we go from capital markets trading, which is really the big use case for stablecoins today? If you look at the $100 billion or so of stablecoin in sort of circulating supply, a lot of that, most of that, is being used for capital markets trading, mm-hmm. Of which you guys participate. What is the journey from that activity to maybe payments?
Yep.
And you guys recently bought out the DM assets from Facebook, which mm-hmm. was the Facebook, blockchain and technology for building their own stablecoin. So I'd love your thoughts kind of on the general path from capital markets to, you know, to payments.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. And then just to warn you, I'm going to kick it back to you because I'm curious about Visa and USDC because I think these, and I know you're not there anymore, so I don't know if you can talk about it. But anyway, so you're absolutely right, Terry. The current use case for stablecoins is overwhelmingly for cryptocurrency trading. And there's a clear use case there. This was not something where somebody was sitting in their garage trying to come up with a tech that they hoped would be useful, but it was really born out of a need. And it was the same need that we were trying to address. What we were trying to address was the ability to transfer a dollar around the ecosystem 24/7. But importantly, it's the SEN is not a blockchain, and we'll come to DM in just a second. So we did not need to create a blockchain in order to facilitate moving dollars, as long as both customers were banking with us. And we created an API that's proprietary that allows our customers to move dollars amongst themselves 24/7. But again, it is, and then that is what enabled the stablecoin issuers, the regulated ones inside the U.S., to really grow and prosper. So I heard the previous panel talk about Terra. There's another stablecoin out there. So Terra was algorithmic, destined to fail. There's another one that's been around the longest called Tether, which is offshore. It's not in the United States, not regulated in the U.S., and we don't bank them because they don't have a clear regulatory construct in the U.S. But the other stablecoins, the biggest one is USDC, issued by Circle. And that stablecoin has over $50 billion of U.S. dollars sitting in a bank or in multiple banks backing that stablecoin. So the difference there is, as we talk about Terra, that was algorithmic. There was nothing backing it whatsoever. Tether is backed by dollars and other assets, and they do an attestation on a periodic basis to say, okay, we've got these assets backing the stablecoin. And then you move inside the U.S. and you have USDC, but there's others. There's also the Pax dollar, the Gemini dollar, and TrueUSD. All of those stablecoin issuers bank with Silvergate, and they use our API for minting and burning their stablecoins 24/7. So if one of their customers comes to them and says, I want to purchase USDC, they send dollars into Circle's bank account at Silvergate. When those dollars hit that bank account, there's an automatic API connection that then mints the USDC on the USDC, whatever protocol. They use Ethereum. They also, I think, use Algorand and a couple of others. And so as soon as the dollar comes in, a USDC token is minted on the blockchain and sent out to that customer's wallet. Now, again, all of that is currently being used primarily for cryptocurrency trading. Where what we see at Silvergate is that this same technology, putting a dollar, a tokenized dollar on the blockchain so that a dollar is a dollar, just like, you know, I've got dollars in my wallet, physical dollars, I can have tokenized dollars in a digital wallet on my phone and then use that to pay for things, whether that be an e-commerce site, whether that be going to Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. You know, right now I've got both the Dunkin' Donuts app and the Starbucks app on my phone, and I load it with dollars using my debit card or my credit card, but that's not interoperable. I can't go into Dunkin' and spend my Starbucks dollars that are sitting in my Starbucks app. But if I have a digital dollar that's been tokenized, there's a dollar backing it in the bank account, and that can move around the ecosystem. It's instant settlement, and it's 24/7. So that's where we really see the unlock for consumers. But again, we're not a consumer bank, so we would intend to partner with digital platforms who would essentially, we would issue the tokenized dollar using what was previously called the DM blockchain before we purchased it. We haven't renamed it yet, but we will. And we're going to kill that name. So Terry, what I want to ask you is Visa actually, and this was sometime in the last year or so, I think Visa enabled USDC, and clearly you all saw a payments use case for that and not cryptocurrency trading, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, just to kind of walk through what Visa did, and again, you know, I'm not there anymore, but the strategy at the time is very much to facilitate the settlement of currency. If you think about the payment networks in crypto terms, these are highly centralized, trusted layer twos, right? So like I go and I tap my US-issued Visa card at a tube station in London, and that tube station immediately accepts the payment. So that's a layer two, highly centralized, highly trusted authorization network. I'm allowed to like enter the tube. But Visa and the other networks are sitting on top of these like slow, buggy fiat layer ones, because we still have to get money from my issuing bank to the acquiring bank of that tube station in London. And that's the layer that Visa is looking at having USDC as a settlement currency.
Got it.
And that's a pilot program that we sort of started, you know, last year, and kind of we'll see where that goes. But I think, you know, more broadly, the notion of stablecoins for consumer payment, I think it'll take a while to get to the point where you're getting sort of peer-to-peer transactions. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the questions we look at is, if you're a merchant and you want to accept a stablecoin, is it USDC? Is it USDP? Is it the to-be-named DM coin? Is it on Ethereum? Is it on Algorand? Is it on Polygon? Like, what? These are like a lot of technical decisions to accept a tokenized dollar, and you know, I'm not sure that we're. Until we have better standards and more kind of simplification, that's a lot of work for a merchant. So maybe over time that'll transpire. But certainly, if you go to the underlying settlement networks, I think you have a lot more opportunity, which is why I think capital markets trading, why settlement seems to be a place where you know stablecoins are active. Just a quick question on DM and the approach that you're taking. That's a closed network, right?
So yes.
If you look at sort of banking around the world today, we've got banks, you know, JPM have got their JPM coin inside of Onyx. That's a closed network. You're a bank that accepts open stable coins. I can deposit, you know, USDC or dollars. But you also have your own closed network. Can you say just a little bit more about some of the advantages of having a closed network for a, you know, for a stablecoin?
Yeah, one of the big trade-offs when you use a permissionless blockchain is by definition then you're in some fashion you're slowing things down because you now have to have some form of validation across a network that is essentially trying to reach consensus, and they're all talking to each other. And you know, whether it's proof of work or proof of stake, if it's permissionless, then there has to be some consensus mechanism, okay? If you're permissioned, if it's a walled garden, you know, to use a pejorative term that a lot of folks don't like, but then you can have validators who have all been permissioned or authorized so that this can happen, you know, very, very quickly at scale. You know, we're talking about, you know, Visa type scale as opposed to Bitcoin type scale, which, you know, can only do, you know, a certain number of transactions is, you know, that's, it's pretty limited. And so we actually believe that both will exist. There are currently both permissioned and permissionless, you know, networks out there. And so it'll be the trade-off that, you know, so if you want the trust, and this is, I think, what the banking regulators want. In the prior panel, there was reference to the president's working group, and there was a report put out on November 1st of last year on stablecoins. And there's a clear desire on the behalf of banking regulators to have stablecoins issued inside the banking system. Yeah. And
by the way, that would make sense from a regulator's standpoint.
Of course it would. but trying to walk that line between, okay, well, issuing on both permissioned and permissionless, I think it's primarily because there are different use cases. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but I think Silvergate's well positioned to participate in both.
Yeah. So maybe just one question to end on. Both at Visa and at DriveWealth, we serve global consumers. There's about 1 billion people today who are connected through a digital wallet around the world, some sort of neobank. They have a digital account to access financial services. The question I have for you is, as those global populations enter financial services, do you think the U.S. dollar increases its market share relative to every other currency, or it's going to shrink as we have a digital euro or a digital naira?
Yeah, our view is that this is a way to actually continue the strength of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world by essentially enabling people all over the planet to have a tokenized digital dollar in their wallet, in their phone, no matter where they are. And I think that should help maintain the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency.
All right. Well, next year at FinTech Nexus,
yes,
23, we will come back and check in on that. Thank you, Alan, for joining us.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks, everybody.